This is Audible.
Sound Booth Theater presents Dungeon Lord, Otherworldly Powers, The Wraith's Haunt, Book 2. Written by Hugo Huesca. Narrated by Jeff Hayes. Featuring Annie Ellicott as the entire female cast. Chapter 1. Catalan. After the Thieves Guild had betrayed her and sold her off to catacomb-dwelling cultists, Catalan Locksmith had started to suspect she was going to have a bad day. Her suspicion became a certainty when the residual necromantic magic from whatever ritual was taking place in the quarries below started to reanimate the corpses in her cell. Catalan always made a habit of looking at the bright side of life. For example, she may have been seconds away from a painful and excruciating death via zombie teeth, but at least she now knew why Undercity was suffering from a particularly nasty undead plague, and out of season one at that.
Someone ought to do something about it,
she reckoned. As long as that someone wasn't her. She had enough on her plate already. She had to free herself, escape a heavily trapped, undead, and cultist-infested catacomb, and finally, had to get revenge on the man that had betrayed her. Many experience points awaited her if she survived. Maybe she would disrupt the cultists' ritual, if she had the time, as an encore. The mummified corpse shook weakly in its embedded stone coffin in the wall next to her. Catalan wasn't an expert in magic of any kind and couldn't tell how long it would take for it to rise and look for its breakfast inside her innards. She had to hurry. Sadly, the cultists had frisked her before chaining her to the skull-covered wall of the ossuary, and they had removed all her tools, including her lockpicks. At least it meant the cultists took her seriously and gave her the respect she deserved by her skill as a thief. In any case, they had forgotten to silence her to prevent her from using magical talents or items. It was an understandable omission, since she was a full-on thief and not one of those fancy multi-classed third-rate amateurs that liked to substitute skill with magic. The chains locking her arms above her head rattled loudly as she pushed against the skulls on the wall and fought for a better position. She didn't worry about the noise. The ossuary was inundated by the cruel incantations of the cultists down below, a constant song with ineffable lyrics from one of those dead languages with more consonants than vowels. Her movement accelerated the creation of the zombies, but so far she could afford to ignore them. With 350 experience points to her name, Catalan could deal with a couple newly born undead. If she freed herself. Using her right hand, she pulled at the fingernail of the little finger of her left hand as if she were trying to tear it off. The fake nail came off painlessly, and she held it tightly. If it slipped, she'd be screwed.
Peaches and cream,
Catalan whispered. The words were the last required trigger for activating the magic of the nail, which promptly heated up to an almost unmanageable level. The nail changed shape and size until it became a guild-certified lockpick. While she worked on the padlock, the mummified corpse managed to push its coffin out of its hole in the wall. The rotten wood smashed against the ossuary's floor. Splinters flew in every direction, and the noise briefly overpowered the cultist's song, which was gaining in intensity by the second. The zombie spilled out of its destroyed coffin and tried to figure out how to stand up. Zombies had a mind score of 3 or 4, if Catalan recalled right. It meant the zombie would need a second or two to figure out how to stand up. She used this knowledge to push down the pang of fear that threatened to blossom inside her chest. Trembling hands could be the doom of any thief, regardless of skill. The padlock clicked open just as the zombie regained verticality for the first time in decades. It raised dusty brown arms in Catalan's direction and fixed a hungry stare on her. Its ocular cavities were 2 empty wells.
Sorry,
Catalan told the zombie.
Don't get too fond of walking just yet.
She swept the corpse's feet off the floor. Zombies were as agile as they were smart, so the corpse smacked head first against the hard stone surface of the floor with a dusty thud. Before it could rise again, Catalan stomped on its skull, which crumpled under her boots as if it were made of clay. Killing the zombie earned her 0 experience points, since a singular low-leveled undead posed no risk to her even if she was unarmed. But opening the padlock under duress and with a time constraint did earn her a marginal amount of points, as well as a rank increase in her lockpicking skill.
That's the thing with you,
Catalin told the remaining two zombies and the singular reanimated skeleton shuffling toward her from the other side of the ossuary.
I keep getting stronger, but you stay the same. Farming you is a waste of time.
Then again, she was unarmed, and skeletons were trickier to dispose of than zombies. Before the undead could corner her, she rushed the closest one, the skeleton, and tackled it into a wall. Skulls broke under the impact of the undead's ribs and the thief's shoulders, and fragments of bone showered her face. Behind Catalin, the two zombies extended their arms toward her neck, so she grabbed hold of the skeleton's arm and launched it against the zombies. As she did so, the skeleton's elbow broke, leaving the arm in Catalin's possession, which solved her unarmed status. Catalin used the extra reach of her improvised weapon to push the bigger of the two zombies away from the others, then kicked at the skeleton's knees. As it fell, the skeleton clung to the nearest zombie and brought it down too. Normal, intelligent creatures would have learned by now to protect their legs against Catalin's attacks, but without the presence of a necromancer or a higher form of undead, these monsters were too stupid to figure it out in such a short amount of time. The third zombie fell the same way the others had, and the thief calmly eliminated them one by one by stomping on their heads. She made sure to spread the bones of the skeleton far from each other, to stop them from recombining. Catalin was alone in the ossuary, her and the truly dead. For her troubles, she was 5 experience points richer. It wasn't a lot, but they added up. She discarded the bone arm and waited for her breathing to calm down. It took longer than she'd expected. It was the song. Too frantic. Now drums had joined the fray, and the noise was pounding the side of her head in the beginnings of a migraine. She was acutely aware of the smell of embalming potions that permeated the ossuary. Strange. As far as she was aware, the catacombs had smelled, to her, only of dust and mold. The reason why would have to remain a mystery. She needed to leave the catacombs before the cultists decided they had arrived at the part of their ritual that required a sacrifice. The door to the ossuary was locked, too, but that obviously wasn't a problem for her. After dealing with the lock, she pushed open the heavy wooden slab. Then she froze, and a scream died in her throat as bright sunlight stung her eyes. Where Catalin's brain had expected to see a bone-decorated and badly lit passageway, it had instead found a park in the middle of the day, filled with people dressed in strange clothes of happy colors. After the initial shock had passed and Catalin's eyes adjusted to the light, she had to deal with many smaller shocks as her mind sifted through the raw amount of data thrown at her in short order. First of all, she had stepped into another world. No doubt about it. The people here were as different from their Ivalian counterparts as a Batblin was from an elf. These men and women were slower, better fed, and even taller on average. Judging from the insanely high quality of their strange clothing, every single one of them had to be of noble station. Away from the paved road that crossed the park, hundreds of magically powered metal chariots roared one after the other down a street so densely populated that it put even Galtia, capital of Steravos, to shame. And the buildings that grew above those? Some of them rose higher than her eyes could see without craning her neck, colossal structures of glass and metal that defied everything that Catalin knew about modern Ivalian construction techniques.
Bullshit,
she muttered, feeling silly for falling, albeit briefly, for such an obvious trick.
That's some creative use of illusion spells, but whatever wizard did it, they went too far and made it unbelievable. So it's easy for me to pass the mime contest.
She looked back over her shoulder. The entrance to the ossuary was still there, the remains of the undead still sprawled across the stone floor. No one besides her seemed to notice the magical doorway, however. Since this world offered better prospects than the situation she had come from, Catalin abandoned the door and explored her surroundings. It was easy to get lost in the movement of the crowd. Her clothes and demeanor should have clashed with the natives, but no one gave signs of realizing she was there. When she understood this, the idea of going around cutting purses and emptying pockets was almost overwhelming. But first she had to find the wizard who was powering the illusion enchantment, since that was the most probable source of the spell that had brought her here in the first place. Above the chatter of the families walking next to her came the ring of bells. It was a happy tune, catchy, probably the work of a skilled bard. Something in the music gently urged her to find its source, an embedded bardic utterance, no doubt. The music came from one of the metal chariots. This one was big and bulky, rectangular, white, and with an unrealistic depiction of a cow painted right at its middle. The cow held a light brown pyramidal shape with a ball of yellow lard over it. A group of little kids surrounded the back of the armored chariot, many of them already holding a cone with lard on top in their little hands. Catalin liked children. They were excellent distractions in the middle of a heist. She walked closer to the chariot, gently urged by the ringing of its hidden bells. She could see now the man who had been hidden by the back of the chariot so far. He stood in the middle of the crowd of kids, and he was in the process of handing them more treats in exchange for some coins. The first thing Catalin noticed about the man was his legs, then his uniform. It resembled that of a baker. White, crisp trousers, a black leather belt, polished black leather shoes, a white shirt that would have earned the derision of undercity fashionistas, and a white overall to finish the ensemble. He also wore a little cloth hat on his head. What was a man like that doing selling goods to children in the street? If he could afford those shoes, he had no need of acting as a common merchant. Catalin had a keen eye for wealth indicators, a natural development of her profession. It was the reason she'd scanned the man's outfit first and paid attention to the rest of him second. But when she did, she paled so fast that her golden brown skin must have resembled the porcelain white of the monster dressed as a merchant. His face had no features, no nose, no ears, no lines of expression, only a pair of tiny black eyes and a gigantic smile that extended far wider than what it should have, and with more teeth. His legs and arms were too long for his body, and thin enough that supporting the weight of his torso should have been impossible. Yet something told Catalin that the man was hiding his full height, as if he were somehow slumping. Like the pieces of a riddle in the treasure chamber of a dungeon lord, facts inched together inside her mind. She had been taken to another place by a mage extremely skilled in portal magic, and she was hidden from the native's sight by a power that went beyond mere illusion. Catalin had grown up with tales and grim songs of such a being, same as most of the children in Skaravos and Locia. A monster with a hungry smile, capable of bending space and time without effort. Charon, the boatman, the black emissary of Murmur. Death and tragedy followed where Charon was sighted. To gaze upon his stats sheet caused warlocks to lose their minds. People believed he stole children from their cribs and grown men from the arms of their loved ones, and brought them to terrible worlds to fulfill the cruel will of Murmur. "He'll come in the night time bearing gifts," the old crib song went. "But his smile is hungry, and he cleans his teeth with the bones from my baby's hand." The boatman turned to look straight at her with those tiny black eyes of his. The space between his teeth was cavernous. Catalin ran. She ran for a long time, but when she dared to look back over her shoulder, she was only a couple steps away from Charon's white chariot, and the monster himself regarded her with a warm, inviting smile.
"Now, now, Catalin Locksmith," Charon told her as he handed a new cone to a delighted little ponytailed girl. "That is no way of greeting an old family friend, especially one who just saved your life."
His fingers, she noticed, were like long white worms. Catalin recited Alita's name, the name of her seven holy avatars, and the name of the three divine consorts, just to be sure. According to legend, that ought to be enough to call golden fire from the sky unto the boatman and throw him back into the pit whence he had come. Charon stood there, smug in his unburnt state. Catalin reflected on her situation.
"Well, fuck,"
she thought.
"But the legend," she said. No dark avatar shall wander mortal realms.
As long as the light shines over them,
Charon finished for her, nodding along like he was quoting his favorite part of a bardic song.
Yes, quite. The thing is, the light can't shine everywhere, and even in Ivalice there are blind spots. This particular realm, though, has been missing its divinities on both sides of the spectrum for a couple hundred years now. Free for the taking, right? I've grown quite fond of the place. I like to stop here for breakfast before work.
Since the boatman had his attention focused elsewhere, the group of children slowly drifted away, their multicolored lard cones melting over their hands.
On the bright side,
Catalin thought,
at least those kids won't be anywhere near him for now.
She then realized, with dawning horror, that a boy and a girl remained behind. They eyed the open back doors of Charon's wagon with mischievous grins. Despite Catalin's screams trying to warn them, the kids inched forward past Charon's back, their gazes never leaving the promised treasures of the wagon's interior, which appeared entirely black to Catalin. Her hands passed through the kids' shoulders like a ghost. The happy tune of the bells drowned all other sounds. After the last kid, the boy, had climbed inside the wagon, the doors closed on their own. No one noticed, except for Catalin.
Let them go!
She pleaded.
Oh, don't you worry. The girl, Sarah, is about to go on an amazing adventure. Sarah will find herself in a world she'll grow to love, and she'll likely become a legendary hero. A good old time all around.
And the boy?
Diego? His adventure will be a bit shorter, I'm afraid.
Catalin lunged to attack the boatman, but she was a ghost to him too, and she couldn't harm him.
Anyway,
Charon went on once Catalin had worn herself out.
As I was saying, I brought you here to save your life.
I don't want your help, aberration. Whatever pact you have to offer, I reject it.
Smart decision, but irrelevant. The pact is already made,
Charon explained happily.
Your father made it, you see, right before he went and plunged Staravos into war.
Mixed feelings coursed through Catalin at the mention of Torst Locksmith.
Torst would never have wasted resources on protecting me,
Catalin said. Charon shrugged.
People are complex. Figuring them out is Murmur's thing, not mine. Good old Torst made his pact and added a small amount of protection for his descendants into his conditions. Definitely not enough to be wasted on trivial thief matters. It is protection meant for something a bit bigger than that.
This is a trivial thief matter,
Catalin told him.
Some cultists and an asshole ex-partner that sold me out to them. I've survived worse. I don't need your help, monster.
Yes. Thing is, you're sadly misinformed. Your captors aren't cultists. In fact, they think of themselves as freedom fighters vying for Staravos' independence. Which is a bit ironic, and kind of fitting, given that their country's lack of freedom is your family's fault. In a way.
Charon winked at her, which was a hard feat given that he had no visible eyelids.
See, Catalin, you aren't getting my help. Not even Torst Locksmith would have had something valuable enough to exchange for my direct intervention. Instead, I'll find you a nearby ally of about your level of experience points. A young man who owes me a small favor. I'll bring this ally to you in time to assist you in your darkest hour, which should come,
he glanced up at the sky,
in about 6 to 7 hours, give or take.
Catalin stared at the unholy abomination, too stunned to be scared of him anymore.
A thank you would have been nice,
Charon sighed and made a carefree gesture with his hand, like swatting away a fly.
In any case, It's time to return your soul back into your body. The rebels are sending someone to your cell as we speak. If you hurry, your escape plan may yet go unhindered.
A brutal wind, more powerful than anything Catalin had ever felt in her life, caught hold of her and propelled her away from Charon, away from the park and its innocent, unsuspecting people, and returned her violently to her own body. She was in the catacombs, lying on her back in front of the open ossuary's door. The cultist's song had diminished in volume and intensity, as if waiting for something, and she could hear footsteps approaching. Charon found himself alone.
"That's done," he said.
He allowed a brief moment to congratulate himself for his efficiency. Undoubtedly, he was the most productive of all of Murmur's progeny. But the day had just started and, as people from Earth like to say, evil never rests.
"But first,"
he said as he walked to the back of his ice cream truck,
"breakfast."
He went to make himself acquainted with little Diego. Chapter 2. Lord's Council. Lord Edward Wright faced the coffers of his council room with the intense stare of a man facing down his executioner. The coffers were filled with valuables in the same way that the heart of the dark god Murmur was filled with compassion. In other words, Ed was flat out broke. For most of his life, his chronic lack of funding had been the normal state of affairs, but since his arrival in the world of Ivalis, nothing about his life could be called normal anymore. The bare stone walls of the circular chamber underscored this fact. The rough wooden table and chairs in the center of the room looked as if they had been put together by a dozen tiny, unskilled hands. Nothing was adorned. No pelts or tapestries for this dungeon, no precious magical artifacts taken from vanquished heroes, and no trophies for his hard-earned victories. Well, no trophies. Except for one. A single spider leg twice the length of Ed's, encased in a resin-like substance the color of honey. The leg had been an unexpected courtesy from Ed's own drones, a single memento of his battle against Queen Amphoris. The spot where Ed's sword had severed the queen's leg was clearly visible at the end of the trophy. Ed's eyes wandered from the coffers of the leg, and the memory of a little girl's scream stirred in his mind. Ed looked away and suppressed a shiver. There were worse things in the world than lacking money.
"You're cold, too?"
asked a woman's voice behind him. Lavina Odessa Treville of Devon, Witch of the Haunt, stood at the chamber's entrance with her arms crossed and a pout carefully crafted to guilt Ed for his lack of chivalry. As far as Ed could tell, she had just arrived.
"I'm freezing here. You should have used your drones to figure out central heating for the hunt instead of wasting them on the comfort of commoners."
Her accent reminded Ed of Transylvanian vampires in cheesy movies. But as far as he was aware, she really spoke like that. And although she talked of commoners like a dog may speak of a flea, Ed had seen her spend an entire day treating the various wounds of the villagers, shoulder to shoulder with Andrina the herbalist. Of course, Levy had complained non-stop during that time, but that was just her style.
"I thought Lotia was a cold region," Ed told her.
That only added fuel to her pout.
"We use coats in Lotia, like any sane person would. Buy the wetlands. I'm considering buying the resist element's talent and wasting my precious experience points just so I can stop shivering."
She pointed at both her clothes and Ed's. They were dressed in pilfered leather armor from the Barova Watchmen and cheap woolen clothes underneath. They barely did anything at all to stop the bite of the cold, which was amplified by the stone that surrounded them. The leather armor contrasted with Levy's almost gray complexion that, along with her raven-black hair and purple eyes, marked her as Lotian royalty. If there was such a thing as royalty for someone who had lived in one dungeon or another all her life. Ed shrugged.
"We'll work on the heating after we're done dealing with the villagers."
He adjusted the nicked short sword that hung from a strap by his waist and passed a gloved hand over his unruly black hair.
"It's no use. We need grim and intimidating for today's show,
not asshole who needs a haircut. Levy tiptoed around him in a playful semicircle while examining him with a critical eye.
Let's see. You're taller than most of them, except Jorge. But you could use some extra muscle. I don't know, Ed. Can you have the drones make you a cape? That's just what you need.
I'm not wearing a cape. No way, Ed said, thinking of Earth's superhero movies. He fidgeted with his sword again. Levy winced in sympathy.
You're nervous. A dungeon lord worrying about the opinion his prisoners have of him. That's something you'd never see back in Lothia.
They're not prisoners, Ed pointed out. I've never done this before, is all. Levy scratched her chin, deep in thought.
If you're unsure, you could relent and buy that amazing dreadlord aura you have in your advancement path. It creates magical fear in your enemies, doesn't it? Just what you need. And besides,
she added nonchalantly, like her suggestion was a mere coincidence,
it's quite a bit more badass than the other option. What's its name? The defensive aura. Alder can do defense. Leave that to him.
Ed shook his head. I haven't decided yet. The auras are mutually exclusive, so I don't want to lock myself into one path until I absolutely have to. He smiled. Besides, magical fear is probably overkill for these people.
Well, I had to try it. Not my fault if you don't end up a terrifyingly sexy dungeon lord.
Levy shrugged with fake nonchalance. Then her expression softened.
Trust me, they'll be too concerned fearing what you could do to them to worry about your appearance. I saw Lord Kale deal with prisoners 12 times, and Lord Hines 100. Both of them could have worn a jester's costume, and no one would have dared point it out.
Kale had been Ed's predecessor, and Hines had been Levy's stepfather. Sort of. I am not them, Ed said. He had traveled all the way from Earth to this strange new world just so he could prove that to himself. Levy, for some unfathomable cultural reason, had thought that Ed said this as if he needed reassurance.
Oh, I'm sure you have it in you,
she said, and gave him an awkward pat on the back.
It would soil the lordship's reputation if Murmur forged a pact with someone who lacked talent for dramatic entrances and the like.
For the sake of his sanity, Ed decided to accept the compliment. Levy shot him a bright smile, no doubt feeling pretty proud of her pep talk skills. Ed couldn't help but grin at the idea, and for a moment they stood like that, until the silence inevitably became awkward. They each took a polite step back and looked away. Ed coughed a couple times. He and Levy were friends, but theirs was the kind of friendship where both parties felt undeniable physical attraction to the other, while at the same time having mismatched personalities. For example, Ed was freaked out by Levy's obsession with all things evil and undead, and Levy wasn't into Ed's obsession with not being a murderous asshole. So, it was best for both if they kept their distance, at least until their hormones calmed down. The situation was interrupted when Ed heard approaching footsteps.
"Bard incoming!"
Alder's voice came a second before he appeared.
"Everyone's decent back there, right? I don't want my innocent eyes traumatized by a sudden flash of our dungeon lord's arse."
"Fuck off, Alder,"
Levy said.
"I've 3 spells per day now, and I swear I'll spend them all on you if you keep annoying me."
She oozed pride, same as every other time she managed to mention her recently increased spell-casting skill in conversation. Alder was a tall, thin young man. He had a bowl-shaped haircut and blonde hair that flickered red and orange in the light of the torches. He was almost always grinning and looking at nothing, with unfocused blue eyes. He was a daydreamer. Unlike Ed and Levy, he wore only his woolen clothes. His neck was covered by a clean bandage, and he carried a wooden flute tied to his waistband.
"Great," Alder said, completely ignoring her threats. "Thank Alita that you're clothed. Now I can tell our guests to step in. They are getting more nervous by the minute."
"They may be nervous because you keep terrorizing their daughters,"
Levy told him.
"A bard doesn't terrorize," said Alder. "We romance."
Ed spoke over Levy, making gagging noises.
"Let's get this over with."
Alder gave him a mock flourish and left. While Levy hurried to take a seat at the table, Ed made his way in front of the spider leg trophy, his back to the entrance, and waited. Soon, he heard footsteps over naked stone and the faint traces of conversation. The conversation stopped as the villagers arrived in the chamber, which Ed took for a good sign.
All right, Ed. Just like you practiced, he thought.
Levy was right. It was ridiculous to be nervous about this. It couldn't be worse than fighting Ione or killing the Mind Brood. He took a deep breath, focused, and made an active effort of will not to shiver from the cold. Heat surged from his eyes in an almost physical torrent, and the world was bathed in an eldritch green light. When he turned to face the people in the room, he knew his flaming eyes shone in a way that made his skull visible under his skin. There were exclamations of surprise, along with a couple mentions of Alita and some minor forest deity. Deep inside Ed's chest, his black heart pounded with satisfaction at the dungeon lord's adherence to the ancient customs of the lordship.
You've worn out your welcome, he told the four men and women from Barova. You must leave this dungeon if you want to live.
He glared at them, hands on the table, trying to project an authority that he didn't feel.
We're trying to help you, you dolts, he thought.
A middle-aged man, shaped like a pear, was the first to speak.
My lord, we have nowhere else to go.
That was Governor Brett. He wore clothes worth more than everything else in the room added together, but they were torn and dirty, his breeches ragged and stained by various dried substances. One of his boots was missing, and his foot was almost blue from the cold and the traces of spider poison still in his bloodstream. Ed winced and turned his evil eye off. The world returned to its normal color, and he took a seat between Alder and Levy.
There are a dozen villages like Barova not a day's journey away from here, Ed said. Any of them should do nicely. Most of your people left days ago.
Ed and his minions had allowed the remaining survivors of the attack of Barova to rest inside the dungeon, but as time went by, it was clear a small lot of villagers weren't as eager as the others to disappear into the countryside.
Why are you so intent on getting rid of us? Brett went on. We can be useful. Don't think we haven't noticed the state of your installations.
Ed blushed. If you stay with us, all of you will be in danger. Haven't you heard? Dungeon lords and their minions don't have the best life expectancy these days.
Alder shot him an alarmed look, as he always did when anyone mentioned the constant, life-threatening danger they all lived in simply due to their association with a dungeon lord. The bandage around his neck was perfect proof of that. But the governor appeared unconvinced.
You are in need of us, my lord. Yorjay here is the best blacksmith this side of the ocean, and Andrina's skill as a herbalist is worth her weight in gold.
Andrina chuckled at that. Like the governor, she was overweight, but unlike him, she appeared sculpted out of solid rock. The herbalist was old enough to be Ed's grandmother and had skin that the sun had slowly transformed into tanned leather. Her gray hair was pulled into a tight braid slung over her shoulder, and she wore an apron stained by plant matter, grime, and the blood of at least four different species.
I am indeed worth my weight in gold, even though Brett probably spoke without thinking, since he forgot to mention what he is skilled in,
the herbalist said. Then she shot a glance at Alder's neck.
We'll have to change that bandage tonight, dear.
After the initial shock caused by Ed's evil eye, she had been the fastest to recover, and now appeared as comfortable as an otter in her nest. Ed was losing control of the conversation, and he knew it.
It's not about your skills. It's about keeping you alive, he explained.
It wasn't the first time he had made this argument, but it was like speaking to a brick wall.
When the Inquisition comes, and they will come, you want to be as far away from us as possible, because once they peg you for a dungeon lord's minion, they will hunt you down forever. Go hide in some other village, pretend you never had anything to do with Barova, and forget this ever happened at all.
Wouldn't that be convenient for you?
Said a bald, bone-thin old man dressed in the black cassocks that identified him as a member of Alita's church.
We go get killed in the wilderness of this thrice-cursed country, so you can get rid of us.
Zachary, you'd better decide if you hate us or need us before you beg Lord Wright to let you stay,
Levy said. She shot the priest a nasty glance.
You can't do both, and your attitude tires me.
Of course, a creature of the dark such as yourself can't stand me, Zachary told her. I am one of Alita's chosen. a holy avatar of the light in Staravos's forsaken lands. My mere aura is anathema to you.
There's no aura anywhere in your stats. And besides, you were sent to Barova because nobody liked you back home.
She pointed out. She had no way of knowing that, but it was a fair inference.
And since no one likes you here, your only shot at surviving is begging the Dungeon Lord to let you stay with him, since the other villages won't cover for you.
The man's smile had several teeth missing, and he wielded it like a mercenary may wield a flail.
Me? Begging? You are mistaken, wench. I'm merely doing my righteous lady's will by remaining in the midst of the damned and offering you a chance at redemption, like that traitor Gallio should have done instead of leaving us in your hands.
Ed couldn't ignore that.
Redemption by fire, you mean?
He knew the man wouldn't be as confident if he were talking with the usual Ivalian dungeon lord, who would have summarily executed a member of a competing faith and forgotten about it. There was little Ed could do, though. Levy was right. If he expelled Zachary without a second thought, the man would die before he managed to leave Hoya Forest. That would be the same as Ed killing Zachary himself. Which frustrated Ed to no end.
Please don't antagonize the deadly spawn of the dark,
Brett chastised Zachary. Then he told Ed,
Believe me, your unholiness, I would like nothing more than returning to Haligies and forgetting I was ever here. But, like Zachary, I fear I lack the locals' favor. As it turns out, a decade of loyal service as their governor left that ungrateful lot little appreciation for me.
I like how you made yourself into the victim, even when it was Haligies who conquered and occupied Staravos,
Alder said. From what Ed knew of the bard, Alder was genuinely praising Brett for his narrative mastership. Because talking to Brett was getting him nowhere, Ed tried Andrina.
What about you? People love you. You could go wherever.
Andrina shook her head, which made her gray braid shake like a whip.
Yes, but only for a while. The Inquisition has never liked herbalists. We compete with their clerics, and we tend to get blamed when anything goes wrong. So I may get persecuted no matter where I am, once they come knocking. Besides, and this is more important, I still have a dozen sick men and women too weak to make even a short trip through the forest.
He couldn't argue with that. So he tried the last one of them. Yorje was a blacksmith, a man of shoulders so broad he may be able to subdue a bull with his bare hands. His forehead was prominent, and his receding hairline made it look as strong as a hammer. Ed had heard that before the spiders had captured him and his family, Yorje punched a spider warrior to death.
And you?
Yorje was a local man, born and raised in Staravos. Besides, he had a family, a wife and two daughters. Surely he would agree that it was best for their safety to stay as far away from the haunt as possible.
I have a family to protect,
Yorje stated.
That's why we're staying. I saw you fight for my people, Edward Wright. I saw how you stood against the Spider Queen, risking your life for my family. Throw me as many eldritch glances as you want, but I know people, and your witch has more evil intent in her than you do.
Thank you,
said Levy, genuinely touched.
Mind broods attacking out of nowhere. The eyes of the Inquisition on us, even Kaftar cackles roaming around,
Yorje went on.
The clouds of war are in the air, Edward. And in war, the first to die are the farmers and the peasants. The powerful care not about us when they have armies to feed. No, in my opinion, we have a better chance to survive if my family sticks with you.
Yorje had been the first Ivalian man who had actually believed Ed when he had explained he had no ill intentions. He hadn't even asked for a pact to make sure Ed spoke the truth. A few days ago, before Barova's fire, before the Mind Brood, Ed would have only dreamed of inspiring that kind of confidence in anyone. But now, after knowing the kind of beings that he was up against, Ed found Yorje's trust bittersweet.
If I let you stay temporarily, he said, you'll all have to earn your keep.
I was of the idea, said Zachary, that the Forsaken Minions of Dungeon Lords received a salary for their services.
Don't push it, damn you!
Brett chastised him.
You're not my minions, Ed said.
and this time he allowed no discussion. The Inquisition had diviner spells that detected the Pact presence in anyone, which the Inquisitors considered problematic, and their favorite way to solve problems was...
Let's just say, your guests. We'll find a way to get Brett and Zachary back to Halagis, then wait until the Inquisition passes by Starevo so Andrina and Yorjay can leave safely. In the meantime, you'll work hard and abide by our rules. Is that understood? I'm not playing around, Zachary. Try anything funny and you won't like what happens next.
In any case, Ed had already asked Queen Laurel to play spiderlings to watch the old priest.
I wouldn't expect anything more from the likes of you, Zachary said. Don't worry, friend Edward. This is the right decision for your soul.
Thank you, your accursedness, said Brett, standing up.
He seemed to be in a hurry to leave the room, most likely so Ed wouldn't have time to change his mind. That, or to escape before the Dungeon Lord could think of what work to assign him. The four villagers left shortly thereafter, leaving Ed, Alder, and Levy alone to discuss the situation.
Just what we needed, Levy said. More mouths to feed.
Alder scratched his chin, deep in thought. Finally, he looked up.
Minions get paid? Oh, here I was doing this for free!
Levy raised an eyebrow.
Alder, you were Kale's minion too,
she reminded him.
Wait, you're saying that Kale paid us?
Alder said indignantly.
No one told me that!
Neither Ed nor Levy were sure if Alder was joking. Once Ed had promised the bard that he'd get paid as soon as Ed figured out how to earn any money, they left the chamber and headed to meet with Kes. The dungeon that Ed was building over the ruins of Lord Kale Arpadel's old outpost was beginning to outgrow the caves it was situated in. A small web of tunnels connected the different sections of the dungeon. The seat room, the entrance, the chamber they had just left, the storage cellar, and the living quarters. In addition to that, Ed had used his drones to build a temporary encampment outside the cave, clearing a small area of the surrounding forest to do so. Instead of heading up toward the exit, Ed and his friends took a short tunnel lit by torches. The tunnel brought them into a new section of the dungeon constructed under the instructions of Kessa of Green, who waited for them at the room's midsection. Clek the Batblin waited next to her and waved at Ed when he walked inside.
Oh no, absolutely not,
Levy muttered when she realized what she had walked into. She made for the exit, but Alder intercepted her.
If I'm going to suffer the indignity of physical labor, Alder told her, you certainly are too, my dear witch.
Ed couldn't fault Levy for trying to run. The room was intimidating, partly because it was the biggest section of the dungeon yet, and partly because of its intended function. Back on Earth, Ed had vowed many times to work out religiously, usually as his New Year's resolution. Every time, he ended up going to his university's gym for about 2 weeks, and then he forgot all about it until the next New Year. So, the place he arrived at didn't look entirely alien to him. Some apparatuses he could recognize, except these versions were built out of wood, iron, and stone in the crude manner of his own drones. He saw benches, rough weights for exercise made of stone, and even a climbing wall fashioned out of wood stakes fixed to the wall. The contraptions dominated a third of the room. Kes had also added a row of training dummies and punching bags in the opposite end of the place. The punching bags were built out of tanned leather and filled with dirt. They looked like the natural enemy of human hands. A couple more stamina-building tools closed that section. Finally, in the middle was a great circle on the ground, made of compacted sand and with stakes surrounding its edge, each of those stakes connecting to the others next to it by thick ropes. Ed realized he was seeing a crude battle ring. The training weaponry that was neatly placed in stands around the ring confirmed his suspicion.
Welcome, Lord Edward.
Kes greeted him with a curtsy. Bowing was extremely out of character for the mercenary, and it immediately put Ed on high alert.
What do you think of your new training center?
It looks like you enjoyed building it, Ed said dubiously.
He flashed his evil eye around the place and used his mantle to copy the room's schematics into his own dungeon-building magic.
I did,
Kes said, as she raised her own training longsword as a challenge to Ed.
Oh, I did.
Chapter 3 The Line.
She looks awfully happy that she gets to fight you,
Alder whispered to Ed. You don't have to do this, you know. You're the boss. Tell her to go easy on you.
Actually, this was my suggestion, Ed said. He gestured around the training center.
You're insane,
Levy told him.
Why waste your time with physical training when we can do magic?
Cass overheard that remark.
I'm sure people fear your arcane might, Levy, for about 2 spells a day. After that, no offense, but you're but a glorified peasant.
I do take offense,
Levy snapped back.
There's more to witchcraft than combat. Research, building magical items, developing magical traps, raising the spirits of the dead. Just wait until I get a couple more skill ranks to my name and you'll see. You'll all see!
Okay, said Ed. But we do need to survive until then, right? This is how we do it. Fact is, we need to learn how to defend ourselves. There's a dangerous world out there, and we don't exactly have any allies. Levy sighed and made another pout. Then she said,
You know what? Go ahead and fight her. I want to see how that goes. That's the spirit,
Kes said. It took a small effort of will for Ed's smile not to falter. He wandered over to the rack of training weapons and selected a longsword. It was heavier than he'd expected. He stowed his iron shortsword in the space left by the training weapon.
See, Levy? This is the reason I insisted neither you nor Alder spend all your experience points, Ed said as he walked into the ring. Our talent options are limited by our skills and attributes, and if we don't take care to grow as much as we can, we'll either waste experience points on non-optimal talents, or have to let the points go unused. Which makes us easy pickings. Before being whisked into Ivalice, Ed had been a gamer. In fact, he had played as a wizard in Ivalice Online, a mysterious indie video game that, as it turned out, had real consequences in the world of Ivalice. Magic in the real Ivalice didn't work the same way as in Ivalice Online, for reasons he hadn't yet figured out. Ivalice's magic system was called Objectivity, and, as far as Ed could tell, was a pseudo-intelligent set of regulations that dictated the way people could and couldn't use magic. The rules were set in stone. You could bend them, as Ed was fond of doing, but if you went too far, the results were immediate, absolute, and spectacular. Ed had given much thought to the way his progression would go, assuming he lived. Dungeon lords were natural spellcasters. The obvious strategy to become a powerful spellcaster was to min-max his spell-related talents, which meant focusing exclusively on his magic and ignoring everything else. But that was a trap. Min-maxing worked in video games, where mistakes didn't mean you'd die in real life, and where you could guess what kind of challenges awaited you in the future. Or just Google them. Besides, despite the spellcasting affinity, dungeon lords weren't wizards. Wizards were a different class altogether and had different spells. So, instead of min-maxing his spells, he planned to grow as much as he could, and then he'd figure out the best way he could invest his experience points. Besides, and this was something he didn't plan on sharing with his friends, or even acknowledge aloud, he had been transported to a magical fantasy world and now he had the opportunity to train with a cool elven-ish swordmaster. It was a chance many geeks would have killed for, and he'd never forgive himself if he let it go. He faced Kes with his training sword held tightly with his two hands. Kes was wearing her full mercenary outfit, a better version of Ed's leather armor, with more metal and straps, pouches and pockets filled with unknown materials, and a veritable array of throwing knives. The hawk-like features of her tanned face looked downright intimidating when she was geared like that. Kes followed his gaze and read his concerns.
Don't worry about the knives, I won't use them. I prefer to train in my full gear, so I'm always used to the weight. It helps build and maintain endurance.
Got it, said Ed.
Before we start training,
Kes went on,
I must know in what areas you're lacking and what your strengths are. I have a decent idea from seeing you fight the spiders in the Bane, but I need to be sure.
Kleck the Batblin stepped briefly between them. Batblins were child-sized humanoids, covered in coarse gray hair, with pig-like snouts, veiny ears, and tingling black eyes.
"I would a clean combat,"
Kleck declared with his nasal intonation.
"No spells, no offensive talents, and no droning up, Lord Edward."
"There goes my main advantage," Ed thought.
Both he and Cass nodded to acknowledge the rules.
"Well, then, you both do your best,"
Kleck said, then immediately ran out of the ring.
"Ready whenever you are,"
Kess told Ed, settling in for him to take the first step. Ed activated his evil eye and scanned the mercenary's stats sheet. Kessa of Green. Species, half-avian. Total experience, 482. Unused experience, 42. Claims, Peregrine of the Cardinal Command Army. Revoked. Citizen of the Volantis Enclave. Former. Attributes. Brawn, 15. Agility, 14. Endurance, 14. Mind, 11. Spirit, 10. Plus 1 minion of Dungeon Lord Edward Wright. Charm, 8. Plus 1 minion of Dungeon Lord Edward Wright. Skills. Melee. Improved. 5. Martial skill. Represents the user's fighting technique. Allows access to some martial-related talents. Swordsmanship focus. Improved. 9. Represents the user's specialization as a swordsman. Improves the efficiency and damage of martial talents that require swords to operate. Survival. Improved. 5. Represents the owner's capability to survive when far from civilization. Improved ranks imply they can withstand challenging environments and situations. Military discipline. The user has received military training and can access temporal tactics talents when fighting in a similarly trained group. Knowledge. Volantis Enclave. Basic. 6. Pertains to the user's knowledge of a geographical location. Gives access to talents exclusive to the citizens of Volantis. Flight. Advanced. 6. Represents the user's dominion over flight maneuvers, air currents, and tactics. Advanced status grants access to aerial combat talents and removes agility penalty during air combat. Drill Instructor. Improved. 3. The user has experience as an instructor and can teach martial skills the user already possesses. Improved status allows the user to teach martial skills up to improved status, limited by their own knowledge of said skill. Hunting. Basic. 9. Survival skill. The owner is proficient in hunting and foraging. Tactics. Basic. 8. Martial skill. During combat, if the user is part of a group with access to a tactics talent, they receive extra bonuses. Talents. Cleave. Improved. The user launches a strike against a target. If the attack kills the target, the user automatically makes another against a single new target. This strike is magically guided. Improved status allows the user to attack up to 2 new targets per activation. Energy drain. Activated. Moderate. Power strike. Improved. The user adds +1 to their brawn attribute when making an attack with a melee weapon. Improved status turns this talent into a defensive talent. Defensive talents do not require a verbal trigger. Energy drain. Activated. Moderate. Shield master. Improved. Allows the user to block magically guided attacks as if they were non-magical. Improved status turns this talent into a passive talent. Passive talents have a negligible energy cost. Improved sight. The user's eyesight is improved to peak condition. Regeneration. Basic. The user gains a healing factor 10 times faster than their normal recovery. Regeneration triggers automatically when damage is suffered and requires 10 times the energy used during normal healing. Improved metabolism. Reduces the energy costs of all talents by 25%. The caloric requirements of the user are increased by the same amount. Resist sickness. Basic. Allows its owner to resist disease and sickness. Basic status allows the owner to resist non-magical sickness as if they had endurance of 15 and were in optimal conditions. Clean, well-fed, rested. Resist environment. Basic. Allows its owner to perform and survive in threatening environments for prolonged periods of time. Basic status allows the owner to survive in extreme environments such as a tundra or a desert, even if they lack proper protections. The owner will last one extra day in a moderate environment, one extra hour in a dangerous environment, and one extra minute in a lethal environment such as freezing waters. Energy drain? Constant. Very low. Avian bone density. Eliminates the negative talent, avian fragility, and its endurance penalty. The user loses all flight capabilities. Dungeon minion. The owner is a minion under the command of a dungeon lord. The minion receives bonuses according to the lord's power and are recognized by all the lord's dungeon as an allowed entity, unless otherwise specified. Ed parsed the information as best he could. Kess's stat sheet was huge, and he could infer a bit about the mercenary's story from it. When Ed had met Kess, she had been living in Barova for a couple of years, but according to her character sheet, she had been a soldier, ranked Peregrine, whatever that meant, from a place called Volantis Enclave, and she had been, somehow, able to fly. She had been quite good at it, in fact, but now she had lost that ability, and she considered it a permanent loss since she had bought avian bone density, which she wouldn't have done if she expected to fly again. The nature of her exile was very much Kess's private business, and if she wasn't comfortable revealing it yet, Ed was happy to avoid bringing the topic up. Kess's skills and talents were geared for prolonged combat, which made sense for fighting in an army. She hadn't bought improved reflexes, which so far had been Ed's combat talent of choice. Improved reflexes carried a big energy tax with each seconds-long use. This meant she preferred to fight while conserving energy. She had Cleave to handle groups of weaker enemies and Power Strike to fight single opponents. At some point between the fight with Sephar's Bane and today, she had improved her Shield Master talent, which meant she had taken into account her new situation as a minion of a dungeon lord. It raised her chances of finding herself in conflict with magically adept enemies. The improved version of Shield Master had no energy requirements, which was perfect for her fighting style. Ed put together this evidence and decided that Kess was a thoughtful, gifted fighter. Hell, she had adapted her character build to her evolving situation in a way that was congruent with her pre-planned progression path. Had objectivity considered martial brilliance as a mindful trait, Ed was sure her mind attribute would have been much higher than 11. She was stronger than he was, as well as more resilient, better skilled, and with more experience. To defeat her, Ed's best bet was to take her by surprise using his improved reflexes and try to bypass her defenses before she realized what was going on. The problem was, Kess's combat style was already defensive, and Ed had little doubt that in her time as a soldier Kess had faced improved reflexes before, and since she was still alive, she had developed strategies to counter them. In fact, when she and Ed had fought Ranger Ione, Kess had been confident in facing the Ranger in close combat, despite him having advanced reflexes, the superior version of Ed's talent. Finally, Kess knew of Ed's talent choice and had seen him in action before. She was aware of Ed's singular trump card, expected it, and could counter it. Judging from the glint in her hazel eyes, Kess had followed Ed's thought process so far and knew that he knew that.
I cannot win this fight, Ed thought. So that's why Kess has been so cheerful. Even if we are friends, I doubt she's had the chance to kick a dungeon lord's ass before.
This was going to be a painful experience. And an embarrassing one at that. Alder, Levy, and Kleck were watching him, and even though they couldn't possibly expect him to win, Ed discovered that he wasn't fond of the idea of letting them see him at his worst. He liked his friends, so he appreciated the opinion they had of him, and he feared that their opinion would lower after watching him drop like a sack of bricks. Sure, they had seen him run away from a fight before, when they had fought the spiders in Hoya Forest, but they too had run, and so had Kess. They had never seen him lose. Perhaps he ought to follow Alder's advice and ask Kess to go easy on him.
I'm being childish, he told himself. Trying to trick my friends into thinking I'm invincible? That's something Ryan would have done. Let's be honest here. As their dungeon lord, I'm their leader.
My responsibility to them is to let them know my strengths and weaknesses by heart, so they can adapt to fill those gaps. If I'm too insecure to do that, I could get them killed. Even though he knew what the results would be, Ed activated his improved reflexes without any outward warning and charged Kess with all his strength.